We're sitting here this morning in sunny Manitoba, just south of the border, speaking to Mr. Murray Cormack. And just so that we have your voice on record saying your name, if you could introduce yourself, and then we'll start out with some general questions about your time in the grain trade.
My name is Murray Cormack. We're living here at south of the border in Winnipeg, 111-3285 Pembina Highway.
Good. Now, you came highly recommended, and I also noticed that you are a inductee into the Manitoba Agricultural Hall of Fame. So, we have a short time with you this morning. So, I should say to you that as we move along, if we find that we just don't have enough time, we'll set another interview if that's convenient for you.
Yes, well, I'm sorry about the time restriction, but I had this commitment, and
We understand perfectly.
I shouldn't admit, but we're organizing a golf tournament for our golf club, so
Oh.
we have our closing luncheon today, and we have to blitz everybody on ticket sales so before they get away for the
Yeah.
summer.
Well, and also recognizing that it is April 5th, 2011, so it's nice that you're thinking about golfing. But we'd like to start the interviews by asking people how they got involved in the grain trade, thinking of the grain trade quite broadly.
Well, I was born and grew up on a farm at Rossburn, Manitoba, and my dad was a farmer and also active in Manitoba Pool Elevators. Way back at that time, he was the first president in 1928 of the local board. And so there is that history there. And so I went on after high school and took agriculture at the University of Manitoba. And then did some graduate work at the University of Nebraska and Iowa State. And when I came back, I didn't go directly into agriculture, although I had worked for the Department of Agriculture after my undergraduate work. And so in '67, I went back to the Department of Agriculture and as an assistant deputy minister, and then became deputy a year later. So I was with the government there at that time for about 5 years, and kind of out of the blue, the then general manager of Manitoba Pool asked me to have lunch and said, "What would you think about coming over and joining us at Manitoba Pool Elevator?" So I thought about it, and it seemed, with my background, kind of a good fit and something that I had a feeling for in terms of the long history that my dad had been involved in the pool elevators at the local level. So that was really how I came to join Manitoba Pool.
So your father was a wheat farmer,
Yes,
largely?
mostly wheat and coarse grains, yes.
What was it like on the farm when you were growing up?
Well, it was, of course, I was born in the 30s. Times were tough, but as a kid growing up there, you never would know it, because on farms you produced pretty well everything you needed for your own consumption. And so we lived reasonably comfortable, although I don't imagine money was too was flowing too much, but it still was a comfortable life.
Did your dad talk much about his involvement with the pool elevators?
Well, at times he did, and he was still somewhat active with them, even in the later years. And but he did talk about the early years when Manitoba Pool, when the first elevator was built there in 1928, and how they got started.
Do you recall anything of his stories about them getting started?
Well, not a lot, except that there was, at that time, as you know, many grain companies in Western Canada. And I think we had three or four privately owned companies that had elevators in our town. And so there was a certain amount of concern amongst farmers, some farmers, as to whether or not this was the best arrangement. And the idea of a cooperative elevator company had already started to form. And so I think that's kind of what gave rise to one being established in Rossburn, and of course a lot of other towns in Manitoba.
Was your dad would you say, generally satisfied with the pool movement handling all of the problems that they had hoped that they would handle?
Well, I think he was pretty satisfied with them. He was very loyal to the organization, and I can remember him, one of his nephews, who was still delivering grain to one of the private companies, getting a lecture from my dad as to why he was doing this and that he should be over, because his father was secretary of the Manitoba Pool Local when my dad was president. So Uncle Lorne's son, he was a bit of an outcast there for a while because he wasn't supporting the pool, local pool.
Did he have a reason for not doing so?
I don't think particularly. No, I guess they had been delivering to one of the companies. I said everybody, the other companies before the pool started there. So I think it was probably a matter of just continuing.
And then you said that once you grew up, you went to university?
Yeah, University of Manitoba.
So mm-hmm. When would that have been?
1953, graduated in 57.
With a degree in?
With an ag economics major.
Okay.
And I went to work for the Department of Agriculture up in Swan River, Manitoba, as what they called an agriculture representative for that area. And then from there, I went down to University of Nebraska to do a master's there. And after that, then I went over to Iowa State for a PhD, and then went back briefly to teach at Nebraska, but I had by that time discovered that teaching really wasn't my forte. Well, teaching was, but research was not something that I enjoyed doing, to tell you the truth. I enjoyed the results of research, but I found the doing of the research somewhat laborious and not suited to my... I was kind of unexpectedly came back to Canada sooner than I should and worked for an advisory agency that Duff Roblin had set up. It's called the Manitoba Economic Consultative Board. And it was headed by a chap that I had known and was quite one of the Christensen brothers from Manitoba. There were six of them who all were involved in agriculture at various times. And so I worked for them for a couple of years, and then Duff Roblin decided to wind that organization down because we had two mandates. One was to publish annually a public review of the performance of the economy, Manitoba economy, and the second was to act as an advisory agency to the government on policy. Well, those two things tended to come into conflict because we had a pretty independent board at the consultative board. It was businessmen, mainly businessmen from Manitoba and Labour. University was represented. And, you know, we kind of, said things in our public report as they were. And sometimes that's always not popular with the government of the day. So it was the right thing for him to do. And so at that time, then I was asked to go over to Department of Agriculture as an ADM there.
And, I want to go back. I mean, you just speak through this as, you know, as if, well, then I did this and this and this. And obviously you've had quite a career and a very varied one. And I wanted to speak to you about the role of the... I guess what they were called, the ag rep in Swan
mm-hmm.
River.
Mm-hmm.
Just to help you focus, as I know they do a broad range of things.
Yes.
The focus of our project is the Canada as an international grain trader.
Mm-hmm.
So if, as you respond to any of these, you just keep that in the back of your mind mm-hmm. and think about how what you were doing in all of your
yes.
Positions actually supported mm-hmm. that role. So can we start right back working with the farmers in Swan River?
Yeah, well, the ag reps, as they're called at that time, and still they've changed, I think, names now and restructured a bit. But they were the representative of the Department of Agriculture for that particular area or region. And so they were there to provide knowledge on any programs that the department had that were available to farmers and farm families. And there were we had a home economist at our office too, and she did similarly with the ladies groups and you know, children. And of course, 4-H work was a big part of our responsibility too. promoting 4-H and supporting it. So I enjoyed it because I, of course, grew up on a farm and knew farm people and found it easy to work with them. And being fairly young at that time, there was two ag reps there at that time because we covered right from Bonito on the south right up to the Paw on the north. And although there wasn't agriculture all the way between Swan River and the Paw, but so we worked together and had a home economist there, so we had a fairly good staffing situation in our office, and we're able to work with a lot of different kinds of situations there.
From the grain farming perspective, what were the issues of the day, do you recall?
Well, at that time, a lot of the new technology was starting to emerge in grain growing with new varieties and herbicides that they were just starting to come out, and insecticides. So we had to keep up to date on all of that new technology that was coming out and help farmers, advise farmers on its use and application to their situation. So that was one of the big things in the crop development at that time. And it was post-war, well, 53 was a little bit past post-war, but that was when all this new technology started to really emerge. And there was a flood of it. And new varieties of grain, new herbicides, new insecticides, new methods of cultivation, new farm machinery and equipment. Different kinds of farm machinery and equipment were starting to come out then. And because the tractor really hadn't been commonplace for that many years, even at that time. Early in the 40s, the mobile tractors, as I call them, that were really replaced the horses, were really started in the late, well, my dad got his first tractor in 1939. And so the 40s and early 50s were still kind of pioneer days in a sense with modern, the start of modern equipment. So we had a lot of work in that area with cropping.
What was the producer's reaction to all of this change?
Well, I think they picked it up rather well. You always had what we called early innovators within the community, and often we used them as a source of information and a source of giving reality to meetings where they had actually tried and applied some of these things, and they were very helpful in terms of doing that. And when oftentimes another farmer saying, "I did this," made more. Had more effect than, say, an ag rep saying, "I think this is what you should do," although they both went together well. Mm-hmm. So there was it was picked up, the new technology. It was a good farming area up in the Swan River Valley, excellent farming area, and a lot of good farmers. So it was very progressive.
Yeah. Being a graduate of home economics, who was your home economist up there? Do you recall who was?
I want to say Marilyn Murray. Not Marilyn. She graduated about the same time as I did, maybe a year or two before me. And she was there, and then there was another girl there for a brief time. She came from down in the Boisevain area originally, and she would have graduated around my time as well. Yeah.
You then went from there, if I've got it straight, which I may not, back to university.
Yeah, to the University of Nebraska, yeah.
And what was your area of study, and why to Nebraska versus coming back to the University of Manitoba?
Well, there was a fellow working with the department, another Christensen, and most of the Christensen boys had they had PhDs in ag economics. And Burbank was in our staff, and he persuaded me I should go back to school. So he made, because he had graduated, did a master's down there, he made the contacts for me with the staff down there. And in fact, they were up at an international meeting that next summer in Manitoba, so I got to meet them. And that's the reason I went to University of Nebraska. And it was very good. And in fact, the head of the department who I worked under, still living at the age of 93, in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we see him from time to time.
And what was your area of study?
It was ag economics.
Any particular, well, this research that wasn't your piece of cake, what
well,
what
the
was
research
it?
There was, I was doing research on whether the different farm business models made any difference to the efficiency of the farms. And we did the study in four states, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. It's called the Mink Study. Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas. And so we had worked with the other four universities as well on this, and they had already done a lot of work in this area, and there was a large sources of data pretty much available by the time I was doing my work. So we were testing, like when I say different farm models, one would be, of course, single ownership by an entrepreneur. Another would be various kinds of leasing arrangements. In other words, it would be a cash rent lease arrangement, a crop share lease arrangement, and probably two or three others. So we compared the efficiency of the farms under each of these situations. So that was really what the study was about.
Was it conclusive?
Well, I think it was reasonably conclusive. We were able to identify kind of a rating, if you will, of the relative efficiencies of the different arrangements.
And do you recall what came out on top?
Well, I would guess that it was the single ownership that probably came out on top, although, again, you had different criteria to judge the efficiency because with lease arrangements, farmers were able to get into the business without purchasing and spending a lot of money for land as an asset. So that was some advantage to farmers who didn't have the means to purchase the asset itself, and they could still farm and lease that property. Now, farm ownership, as you know, has been a big tenet in North American agriculture. In some countries, that's not the case. But in North America, that's always been kind of the goal, although it gets questioned from time to time as to why you should spend thousands of dollars an acre to purchase land, in the States especially, when you could rent it. But I'd say it's still the prevalent form of business model, the single proprietorship.
Still,
well, now it's becoming, some cases, a corporate family corporations, and that are common.
Still prevalent, but still questionable as to whether it's almost like home ownership versus leasing, where home ownership is the preferred choice,
yes,
but not necessarily the most economical choice.
Now, in farming, of course, a lot of it is a combination. They'll own land and then they will lease additional land, and that's very, very common, and probably the predominant form still, mm-hmm. where it's neither either or, it's a combination of the two.
So you were at the university,
mm-hmm.
and then you came back to Manitoba.
I came back to the consultative board that I talked about and was there for, I guess, just about 3 years.
Was it an advertised position, or did somebody?
No, Ball, the chairman of the board, he knew of me, and it was his brother that had sent me down to the University of Nebraska, and so he kind of followed my career. And
so, which Christensens were these? Because the Larry Christensen's name
Larry's
has
another
come up.
Brother. Larry
oh,
was
another
at the
one.
Canadian Wheat Board. Leo, the youngest one, was president of the University of Saskatchewan. Al Christensen was worked with our department for a time, and he's a staff member of it at University of Manitoba. Chris Christensen was the assistant general manager at Manitoba Hydro for a time, but he had also been a staff member at the University of Nebraska. And then Burbank, who had been an ADM in the department in here, he worked with FAO in Rome for a time, and unfortunately got cancer and died a relatively young man. So Balder was the oldest one, and Balder had been on staff at the University of North Dakota way back, and there was quite a controversy at that time over academic freedom, and he and Cease Haver, who was another prof, were fired over academic freedom questions, and Balder went to Ottawa and worked then, and C. Saver went to McGill University, and was on the staff there at McDonald College.
Quite the family.
So yeah, they're a very active family, and they're all gone now except Larry. I think Larry's the only one left now of the.
Yeah, we're trying to locate a phone number for him. So if you.
He lives at Gimli.
Okay.
Yeah, so he'll be likely in the Gimli phone book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Larry would be probably the third youngest. Well, he was kind of in the middle of the pack, age-wise. Yeah.
You mentioned Duff Roblin's board that you were working on, and I'm assuming you were there representing the agricultural component of the economy.
No, not really. No, I was there really as an economist and general economy was what we were concerned with. Mm. Now, all sectors of the economy were.
What years would this have been? Approximately, we're not.
60, came back in 65 and left there in 67, I guess it was.
If you can think back to that time and remember, because we are interested mostly in the agricultural segment of the economy, any thoughts about what were the issues then, what they felt changes that needed to be made that, as you said, some of them weren't particularly politically popular?
Well, I don't know. And that's, in the late 60s, agriculture was, perking along pretty good. And a lot of this new technology had been adopted, and farms were growing in size, growing in efficiency. So it wasn't, for the most part, it wasn't that turbulent, other than perhaps weather from time to time, as it does now, would interfere. But no, the industry was going along pretty good at that time, I would say.
Now, this is taxing my memory so early in the morning. Was it directly from there that you had your conversation with the Manitoba Pool Elevator people?
Or was there something in between? No, it was after I went back to the department. I went back to the department in 67 and as an ADM in the department. And then when Walter Weir succeeded Duff Roblin as premier, he made a big shuffle of all the ministers and deputies. And so I was moved to deputy at that time, and the fellow who had been deputy in the department went up as director of the Planning Committee of Cabinet. And so I stayed then, and then the Schreyer government came in June of 69, and I stayed on with their government for till 73. And that's in 73 when Poole came along and said, okay, would you be interested in coming over?
What was a day in the life of a deputy minister of agriculture?
No day was the same. No, it was very interesting, very busy job, as you probably know. I understand, have a
your time is not your own.
Experience on that. Your time is not your own. You think you're going to go in one day doing certain things, and you end up doing something completely different. But it was good, and I had a good minister. The first minister I worked with was a chap by the name of Doug Watt, who represented the Arthur constituency down in the southwest corner of the province under the Conservatives. And then Sam Uskew was the minister in the Schreyer government, first minister of agriculture. And, of course, I didn't know at that time whether they'd want to keep me around, although I'd worked for the Liberal government before and the Conservatives, and I was kind of I guess Harry Enns would call me a political eunuch, probably. That means I didn't have strong leanings in any direction. But anyway, Sam asked me to stay on after I worked with him for a couple of weeks, and he said, I'd like you to stay on. So I stayed on, and then till Poole came along in 74. And as a matter of interest, I just attended Sam's funeral on Saturday. He just passed away here this last Saturday. Mm. And I was a good friend of his over the years.
So the as you were saying, the agricultural sector was percolating along.
I would say it was going pretty well in that
were
time
there
period.
Issues? Were there any issues?
Oh, there's always issues in agriculture, yeah. Okay.
So you know, think again of the grain area.
You see, in fact, I spent a lot of my time as an ADM, the year I was ADM, There were a lot of marketing agencies being established at that time and set up, and so and they were somewhat controversial even within the government itself. Particularly when the Conservative government was there, the Minister of Agriculture, because he had, from his constituency, he had a lot of push to have orderly marketing and establish marketing boards, commissions, whereas Sid Spivak, who was Minister of Industry and Trade, they didn't want marketing boards. So that was always a bit of a rub in there, and I still remember the time when one of the friend of mine from Industry and Trade and I were sent home and said, don't come back till you have a solution to this particular issue over, it was broiler marketing at that time. And so we often laughed about that afterwards. We went, came to our house one time and that night and had chocolate cake, and John always remembered that. I had occasion to work with him years later. He was head of the Transport Institute at the university for a time. And then I did some consulting work with him, and he did with me. In fact, on the document I'll give you, if it's of any interest, he was our research director on that. So,
John
Heads. Yeah, an English, came from England originally, and worked for Industry and Trade for quite some years, and then ended up going out to the Transport Institute at the University of Manitoba.
I'm going to ask about a few connections relative to your position with the provincial government, and I'll probably come back to the same issues when we go on to the Manitoba Pool Elevator situation. You were mentioning marketing boards, so, you know, sort of the granddaddy of the marketing control boards is the Canadian Wheat Board.
Yes.
So would you have had any connection?
We had some connection with it, and of course the Canadian Wheat Board, farmers, the majority, I think, of farmers even today support it. There's always a group that were fairly strong, you know, and fairly active that did not support it and did not want it around. And that was at the policy level, that was an issue. Our contact with, when I was with the provincial government, was not a, I wouldn't say a strong connection there between the board and the department at that time. Provincial departments are more of the, you know, the federal department that is the stronger relationship as it relates to the Wheat Board.
So it continues to be sort of a federal issue. Would the farmers lobby you to take a position?
Oh, they would lobby ministers, yeah. The document I will give you is I was executive director of the Western Grain Marketing Panel, which Ralph Goodale set up in 1995. And we produced a report on the future of grain marketing in Western Canada. And of course it was one of the major recommendations we made at that time. I'm sidetracking a bit here, but was that the Wheat Board be controlled by a board of directors having a majority of farmers on it. That was the major thrust we heard when we held hearings across Western Canada on it. And so that was a pretty major policy change, which he did incorporate into the legislation that he introduced in 1966 or 67. The provincial government, while it would be interested in what the Wheat Board did, depending on which government was in power, there wasn't a lot of going back and forth between the provincial government at either the policy or the technical level, I would say.
Same apply for railways then?
Yeah.
Was it during that time when, or was it later, when the whole rail car issue and the request for provinces to
purchase rail cars? Yeah, that would be, when did that start? That would be, I think, into the 70s, well into the 70s, when they, and also the Wheat Board then purchased a number of rail cars itself. So that would be on a little bit beyond my time in the provincial department. But certainly the department was interested in the wheat board and saw it as a major institution in the grain business. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of policy, the provincial government didn't have a lot of influence, I would say, on whether there should be a wheat board or shouldn't be a wheat board, or you know, various ministers may have had points of view on that, but it was not something that became a major provincial government issue, I would say. That would be my observation. Yeah.
The year that the fellow from, and who was it from Manitoba Pool Elevators who came over to?
Bob Moffat.
To headhunt you.
Bob was the general manager, as they called the position at that time, yes. He was the one that came over. And I hadn't known him well before that. I'd met him, but we had lunch in the old Eaton's, in the restaurant in the old Eaton store. And so he asked me if I'd be interested in coming over. So I thought about it for a week or so and talked some more with him. And then it looked like it might be a pretty good fit. So And I was interested eventually in going into the private sector. And the timing was pretty good. I'd had 5 years, as you know, at the deputy minister level with the province, and I thought, well, I don't see myself here in another 20 years. So I've never been one to kind of be a long term lifer in positions, and I admire people that can do that and remain effective. Although I would say they're not large in numbers. When I first went to Manitoba Pool, of course, there was a tradition of length of service. That time, I remember going to retirement parties where fellows were 45 years, 47 years even, had worked there right from day one. And I admired that. And if they were able to stay effective, which a number of them were, I had more admiration even for them.
And many of them started in... We've interviewed people in Thunder Bay, for example, mm-hmm. with Manitoba Pool that started shoveling grain, and they stayed with the the company for years and years and years. But they always went. Well, we'll get to that one, but let's not lose track of where we are, because then I'll be completely confused.
Okay.
So, in moving then from government into the Manitoba Pool operation, what did your job entail, and also what seemed the same or different from the inside versus having seen it from the outside?
Well, I went over there as assistant general manager at Pool Administration, so things like personnel came under my responsibility, facilities, office facilities, and that came under administration. I think I had one operating department reporting to me. So that's what I went over there to do. And I enjoyed it in the sense that our board of directors met every month, so that if there were problems that management had that or not problems, but issues the management had that they needed decisions on, you're always less than a month away from a board meeting and normally would get those decisions. In government, as you know, you goes forward with something, then it gets referred to a committee of cabinet, and then it comes back to the department, you got to do something more with it, then it goes up to cabinet, they delay a decision on it. So, you know, you can be 6 months eaten up pretty quickly in government and maybe not get a decision. And so I found it easier to get things done, or less time-consuming to get things done than I did in government. And I understand the reasons why. You know, government, I understand why that is the case. But it can tend to be more so than maybe necessary at times. But it's not easy.
That's true.
Bee looks like she wants to say something.
Bee, you look worried.
Oh.
Do you want to pause? Do you want to pause? Okay.
Yes, I think I'm not sure if there's one in there. I think there might be the first door on the left.
So, So it was quite an easy shift because dealing with people in one organization is very much like dealing with people in another
Yes.
organization, except from what we were saying. It was a little easier because you could move along more quickly and probably had a bit more
And as you
control.
know, in the pool, we had quite a, you know, the pools had quite a democratic structure in their organization. So we had a board of directors. Then we had, you know, rural members committees at the local level. And then we had delegates, which are an in-between group between the local members and the board of directors. And the delegates always attended the annual meeting. We'd have a 4 or 5 day annual meeting. So there was a lot of participation by farmers in the organization. And in a sense, that was what it was like when I was out in the field with the Department of Agriculture in my early times doing the ag reps job, because you had a lot of contact with farmers through pool. And I always found that beneficial because we had access to what was happening out in the country, more so than I think some of the private grain trade did have, because we had this structure of local committees, then the delegate structure, then the board of directors, and then the management. Mm. So it was a good structure that we had for participation by farmers.
And from that position then, you...
Well, it kind of moved. From that, they made me general manager of operations, and Bob was doing more of the policy and our affiliated company work. And then when Bob retired, they made me general manager, and then they changed the name of that position to CEO in the early 80s, I think it was. So from 82 on, I guess that was called CEO at that time, but it was basically the same job.
So what were your years at?
At Poole, from 73 till the end of 87.
Okay.
Yeah, about 15 years.
Now, in most organizations, the people who are most far removed from the decision-making area are the ones that have the most concerns or issues, mm-hmm. because oftentimes they're just not aware mm-hmm. of what's going on between.
Yes.
So what were the farmer issues in those days, and what was the pool's response?
Well, within Manitoba Pool, you might say was a kind of a dual organization. In one sense, it was a farm organization policy group. So our members took farm policy issues up within the Manitoba Pool, and so did our board, and with largely with federal government policy, I would say, occasionally with provincial policy, but largely with federal government policy. And then on the other hand, it was a commercial business. So you had those two things going on, and both of those things would be matters that the farmers were concerned with. They would be concerned about better services, making sure their local elevators were in tip-top shape, the new sidings were being put in to handle more rail cars, those kinds of issues at the local level. And we were, of course, pretty large in the fertilizer and chemical business, farm supply business, we called it. So they'd have concerns over, you know, what was happening there commercially. And then we had a livestock program as well. We did we had the livestock markets out of Brandon, which we operated. So they would have a natural concern for the well-being of those services and how they were being accepted by farmers.
And this would be the rail car issue.
The rail car was often an issue, yes. In fact, when, you know, there was always some difficulty getting enough rail cars. There seemed to be, anyway, always that problem. And so that was a fairly constant issue that would come before the local people at the local committees, because a particular location might have, for sort of unique reasons, might have a difficulty because of where their location was and so on, getting adequate rail service, getting rail cars. We're still having that today. And so nothing is, well, I shouldn't say nothing has changed, but...
There was probably a period when the cars that are now on the road or on the rail were purchased. There probably was a time, but now they're getting to the end of their lifespan.
Well, they're going to be getting to the end of their lifespan, yes. And of course, when hopper cars came in, that was a big move forward, because the old box cars were not only a lot smaller, but very difficult to unload at the lakehead. Whereas the hopper cars, of course, you pull them on the track, open the chutes at the bottom, and out it goes. But that improved the efficiency of the rail car situation quite a lot when hopper cars started to come in. So anyway, the pool members at the local level were concerned with both farm policy and with commercial services in the organization.
And the connection obviously would be far greater, your connections with the wheat board in
Yes, we
that
had
position.
A we had a very active relationship with the
Can
Canadian
you
wheat board.
Just expand upon how that relationship
Well,
looked?
for one thing, keeping it on the rail car question, the wheat board were really the coordinators of the delivery of rail cars between the railroads and the grain companies. They did the allocations, a lot of the allocations. So they worked closely with the grain companies to see what the grain companies' needs were. They looked at what the rail car supply was being offered by the railways and tried to match these up and allocate them in a fair manner. And of course, when you get into an allocation process in anything, there's always a lot of issues and a lot of arguments about, well, why did that location get so many cars and the other one not? So we had, our people had a steady relationship with the wheat board people that were handling the transportation at the time in particular. And then we would, you know, our farmer members would raise issues about the board on quotas and policies relating to quotas at the time when that was more of an issue than it has been of recent years. And so there was always a number of matters that we had to relate to the wheat board on. And of course, we're concerned with grain marketing too, because the pools did a lot of their business through affiliated companies, which we owned jointly. And so we had an export company by the name called Excan Grain, and they were exporting largely the non-board grains, because as you know, the board exported all wheat and all barley out of Canada, and oats at one time, although that was taken away first. And so we had, you know, that relationship too with them on the marketing end, and we're interested in what they were doing at the board, because that was what our farmers relied on, was that marketing effort by the wheat board, particularly on wheat, and which were, you know, back then certainly the major crop. Canola has come along as another major crop now, and so it's outside the board. But certainly on wheat, oats, and barley, our farmer members at Poole had, very active interest in the board and how it was doing on the marketing end of things, and of course on pricing, which they always.
Any clashes in goals, or were they pretty much?
Well, as I say,
I
think the majority of farmers supported the board. Sometimes a little frustrated with some of their activities, but or what they perceived as maybe lack of activity, but they were pretty strong. Our members, particularly that belonged to Poole, would virtually all be supporters of the Canadian Wheat Board. Not all of them, but and different degrees of support, but were for the most part strong supporters of the Wheat Board. That doesn't mean they wouldn't criticize if they thought that was warranted, or make suggestions. But we're strong supporters of the wheat board.
The other piece that we've discovered through our time on the project is the Canadian Grain Commission. So
yes.
What would have been the connections there?
Well, that was with the pool. Grading issues were always a concern to producers, and as you know, the wheat board or the Grain Commission. Were kind of a referee, if you will, between the buyer, the manager who was buying grain in both the private trade and the pools, and the producer. Because if the producer felt they weren't being given a proper grade for their grain by the buyer, then they could appeal to the Grain Commission and have the matter either confirmed or dealt with. But the wheat board, or the Grain Commission too, was really paramount in establishing the recognition throughout the world of the superiority of Canadian grain quality. And that was a big job for the Canadian Grain Commission, still is today, although it's maybe being challenged a little bit by some. But it's very important in international marketing of our grain that because in the U.S., for example, when you buy U.S. grains, you're never sure what you're going to get in terms of grade and quality. Not as consistent. In Canada, when that grain is loaded on the boat at Thunder Bay, there's a certificate final issued on the grade of that grain, and buyers can rely on that, and they'll always cite that as an advantage in buying Canadian grain, is that the quality they say they want is what they get, and where in a lot of countries that's not the case. And particularly, I don't know, I'm a little out of touch with the U.S. now, they may have been improving, but oftentimes there was disputes between the sellers in the U.S. and the buyers because the buyers didn't feel they got what they had ordered.
In your positions, in those senior positions with Manpro Pool Elevators, would you have had any contact with your customers overseas, or was that the, I think it's X-Can? Was
X-Can was really our international arm for the grain, and they were the ones that dealt with customers pretty directly outside of it. Now, we'd have, we had a board of, I was on the board of X-Can, and two or three others of our people were as well. So we'd be involved in that policy sense, but not in the day-to-day activities of the international marketing. We'd be interested in it, but not operational in it, let's put it that way.
Now, you had talked about, just briefly mentioned Thunder Bay. So obviously the lots of Manitoba Pool operations in Thunder Bay. So can I just leave it free floating for you to comment on the operations in Thunder Bay and maybe the people that you recall working with and so on?
Yeah. Well, when I went to Manitoba Pool in the fall of 1973, I guess partly because I was in administration and had employee concerns under my wing. The company had always had a Christmas party for the employees at Thunder Bay every year. And so I was asked to go down to that, and I'd only been there a couple of months, but I went down to that and met all the fellows and ladies that worked there. And it was a fantastic experience because I was impressed with the enthusiasm they had and the dedication they had to their work and their jobs, and they wanted to talk about that. We had a dinner and a dance, and so everybody was in good spirits, and I was really impressed with that, and I was impressed, which I later was confirmed as I had more experience working in Pool. They were a tremendously dedicated group of people down there. And the other thing that impressed me was that there was, in many cases, a second generation and even a few of third generation families that were working at Pool at that time. And we were operating two terminals down there then, and a fellow by the name of Johnny Mallon, who you probably know. Johnny was in charge of our operations at Manitoba Pool. And then he had twin boys, Brian and Billy, I think it was, that also then were just starting work really with Manitoba Pools, I recall it. They would have been working at that time, I think, or very shortly thereafter. And I don't know whether they have any family working in it today or not, but this really struck me as quite amazing in one sense, that the generations followed, in that same line of work. And it was hard work, It was not easy work in those years because, as I say, the unloading was pretty antiquated at that time, and it was a tough job working in the terminals at those times. But they seemed to enjoy it, and they were dedicated to it, and they were tremendous employees, as I learned more so over the years. So that was my first impression of the employees at Thunder Bay. And of course, all the labor down there was unionized, as you know, and we used to, we negotiated as a group of companies with the Thunder Bay Group. And a fellow who you may have known, Frank Mazur, was the head of the union and chief negotiator. And we had a lawyer in Winnipeg by the name of Stuart Martin, who was did our negotiating. We all had a committee, and a number of us sat on that committee with him. And so it was very interesting times during negotiations down there. And there was a lot of, you know, brinkmanship played as well. And but we never had really any serious setbacks in that relationship. In fact, our negotiator and Frank, well, they'd across the table, you know, go at it pretty hard. Behind the scenes, they had a pretty healthy relationship between the two of them. So we didn't get into very many deadlocks, so to speak. And so that was a good experience. But the employees never, you know, they welcomed being part of the union, because no question it strengthened their position. But they never, you know, made an issue of that or talked about it as individual employees. And they, as far as I'm concerned, they worked hard regardless of what the situation was, and were tremendous, tremendous employees. And this is a little aside, but I understand from one of our people who used to then run the terminals from Winnipeg later, like was our terminal manager in Winnipeg, tells me that Johnny Mallon may still be living. Now, I haven't seen Johnny for years.
We interviewed him.
You did? Yes. Is that right?
Yes.
And he's still going strong, is he?
He's still going strong. And we interviewed one of his sons.
Yes.
They were fantastic interviews.
Yeah.
You might be interested in one of his Johnny's comments was coming up to the meetings here.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of waiting in line to be called in front of what it would be the management group.
Yes.
And, you know, answering questions. Yeah. About the operations in Thunder.
Yeah.
Bay.
He'd always come to our annual meeting, and then the producers would have a chance to ask him questions. And we always took a tour each summer of our delegates down to Thunder Bay to see the operations and to have a chance to talk to the fellows that were running it there and go through the terminals and everything. And that was an annual ritual that was always followed. And Johnny was great at those, you know, was hosting those meetings. And it was good for our members and good for, and they could ask our members questions too about things from the country that they may not have been as familiar with. So it was a good relationship. Yeah, Johnny was a very, very nice gentleman. And Anne, I gather Anne has passed away.
Yes.
Some time ago. Or was it?
Yes,
yes,
a few years ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of, you know, I guess 23 years away from Manitoba Pool now, so mm-hmm. It kind of, over time, you kind of lose a lot of these connections.
Mm-hmm. The what was happening on the terminal elevator front during your years? It was not the horrible declining years that we've seen in the past.
Well, when I first went down there, there was consolidation starting in the terminals, particularly the older plants on the river. Those were starting to be taken out of operation. In fact, some of them were being knocked down at that time. And so that was kind of the beginning, I guess, although as far as the larger plants go, that was pretty stable for quite a considerable period of time until the movement of grain from Western Canada started to shift from Thunder Bay to Vancouver because of our markets in Asia became larger. Our markets in the UK and Europe and Russia started to decline. So back at, in the mid-80s, maybe a little earlier, there was about 70-80% of Western grain went through Thunder Bay. And that, in fact, I don't know what it is today, but I would guess it's reversed itself.
Yes.
The other way, almost to the same numbers, now going west instead of there. So that kind of forced some further consolidation at Thunder Bay, although that was largely has happened after my time mm-hmm. there. But it was, you could see the beginnings of that starting to happen.
Do you recall how the decisions were made for what stayed open, what shut down? Not obviously between the West Coast and Thunder Bay, but just picking which particular plants you...
Well, those were, you know, private decisions made by each of the companies that owned those plants. They were the ones that had to make those
So Manitopol didn't own any on that?
We were still operating the two terminals when I left there, I think, and now I think it's down to one. Well, it's now Viterra, which now is the former UGG and the three pools. So I don't know what they're operating. I'm out of date now. But, you know, at one time when I first went down there, I think Sask Pool were operating about six or seven terminals they owned. And UGG had two terminals. We had two terminals. Cargill had a terminal. United Grain Growers had two. Did I mention them? Yeah, UGG. Parrish and Heimbacher's had a terminal. Now, I think, I don't know how many are, I think when we did that study in 1995, there were still 11 houses, I think, operating at that time. And I don't know now, I would be guessing, but I would guess Viterra have narrowed that down a fair bit. I wouldn't be surprised if they might be operating one old UGG plant, maybe two of the old Sask Pool plants and our one plant, which would be four. I'm just guessing at that. But, and I think P&H are still operating there, and Richardson's, I think, are still operating there. So it's kind of reached a, you know, a point it's probably not going to go any further. And in fact, it's something you may have heard, and I didn't have time to track it down, but I believe there was a spokesperson from the Wheat Board, I wasn't at the meeting, that made a prediction now that there may be some reversal in that trend back to Thunder Bay because of what's happening in the international marketplace, and South America becoming more of a potential market, and... So that would be interesting if that is going to happen and could happen. And so if that does start happening, then of course it will certainly stabilize the situation in Thunder Bay.
Did you have terminal facilities on the West Coast?
We had an interest in Pacific elevators along with the other three pools. And we were one of the six companies that built the elevator at Prince Rupert. Yeah. So we didn't own outright ourselves anyone, but we were part owners in those other two.
The Prince Rupert one, was that being built while you were?
Yes, I was. I was on involved when Prince Rupert was being built.
So that would have put you in contact with Sid Halter, with the engineering firm that built the elevator.
Yes. I didn't have direct contact, but yes, I remember that. Yeah.
That I think.
Mike. Our CEO there, he was an engineer too, and he was our first CEO. Mike, his name won't come to me, he was a former Saskatchewan pool employee, but he was very involved in the construction and the working with the engineering company that mm-hmm. designed it. But yeah, I remember flying in there into that island when they started work, and it looked like a most ungodly place to have a terminal, but it... I've lost track of what I know it's had its difficulties since then, and I don't know where their volumes are at now or whether they're even at the moment still operating.
And why would that, what were the problems?
Well, at one time, one of the problems was, I think the railroads had a cheaper rate to Prince Rupert than they did to Vancouver, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that got changed. You'd have to check this. I'm mm-hmm. going from stretching a bit here in memory. But that, for whatever reason then, and more capacity was added in Vancouver after that as well. So the need to some extent, my sense was that the need for Prince Rupert maybe wasn't quite as strong as it had been at the time, you know, when it was being planned and built. But I'm out of touch with that. I don't really know what the situation is there now on the West Coast. Yeah.
In our discussion so far, do you think you've touched upon what were the major changes and challenges that you dealt with, or are there others that come to mind?
As far as Thunder Bay is concerned?
Just in general with the grain trade.
Yeah. Well, there's been a very rapid, as you know, consolidation of the companies in the grain trade. Something which I regret looking back. The four pools, the three pools and United Grain Growers, there had been periodically some effort to have the three pools go together, and I think there was a further effort after I left to try it again, but it never was successful in bringing the three together. So Saskatchewan Pool said, all right, we're going to go on our own. We're going to go global. And they kind of went off on their own and made some investments offshore and made more investments than, is it looking back, they should have, and got into some trouble. Manitoba Pool and Alberta Pool then decided that they would merge to try and strengthen their situation, and they did that into AgriCorp, and then I think they made an attempt to take over UGG, but it kind of turned the other way, and UGG in fact took them over and became AgriCorp United. And then I wasn't here, not involved at that time, but I think then that there were discussions between whether AgriCorp United might take over United Grain Growers or vice versa. And I guess whether it was really a merger or takeover, I'm not sure, but they got together, formed United AgriCorp United. And then I think there was some tussle as to what was going to happen with Sask Pool. But they found an investment fund out of New York that was willing to back them eventually, and even though they were in some financial difficulty at that point, they ended up taking over the other three companies and formed it and became known as Viterra and are publicly traded company now. So in my sense, the farmers lost a lot of control and influence on the industry as a result of all of that happened.
Do you think that that issue comes up a fair bit? Will that make a difference, do you think?
I think it'll lessen farmers' influence on the agricultural industry in Western Canada, particularly the grain industry. There's no question in my mind it will.
And what kind of impact will that have?
Well, I think now that you know, the companies that are there now are all, well, not all publicly traded, but Cargill is a private company. But in effect, from the standpoint of interest of farmers, privately run companies, as they should, are there to make a profit for their shareholders. That's number one in their mind every day they go to work. I know that. I worked with ConAgra for 5 years. And that is their number one interest. The pools, I think, well, pools had an interest in making profits. Number one, if they did make profits, most of them got returned to the farmers. But they were concerned with farmers' interests, not only commercially, but on farm policy sense too. So the farmers, I think, through losing the pools, have lost both a commercial organization that acted in their interests and a policy organization that was also lobbying in their interests. So they've lost both of those. And I'm not saying I don't want to be critical of the companies that are now remaining and that them being publicly traded. That's the way our so-called free enterprise system works. But the major difference is that when those fellows go to work every day, they've got their shareholder in mind. And in most cases, they're not farmers. They're not the farmers. There may be a few farmers that own shares in them, but that's minuscule. Whereas when you go to work for the pools, you've got the farmer's interest in mind every day because you know that they're the ones that call the shots. And I think that's a significant difference. And we've had a general weakening in our farm organizations as well. Canadian Federation of Agriculture, now how often do you hear about them anymore? They were once a very prominent organization. Even at the provincial level, how often, you know, I think Keystone here in Manitoba, ag producers are a fairly active group. But they don't have the, you know, they don't have the, they aren't able to marshal the big interests, I don't think, of the farmers beyond the provincial borders.
If the, and as you said, you'd moved on from the pool, Manitoba pool, by the point that all of these mergers, takeovers, buyouts were going on. But so this may be a bit of speculation on your part. Since those organizations like Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, Manitoba Wheat Pool, UGG, I understand to a lesser extent, were farmer owned, mm-hmm. How did all of this happen if the end result is a weakening of the farmer's position?
Well, I can only speculate because I was not there. And I would probably want this off the record.
Just pause, be the button there, yeah. Back
now
on.
I push record.
Yes, you press the lever over. Just going back to the conversation that we were having before we took a bit of a pause, you had commented on how the farmers had lost a major part of their voice with the disappearance of the pools. And that leads me to ask the question about, is it likely from an economic standpoint to lead to a real buffeting of Canadian farming to global markets?
Well, maybe to some extent. I wouldn't want to overemphasize that because the Canadian grains industry has always been very subject to impact from the global market because it's always operated in the global market. As you know, most of our grain is exported from Canada. So we've always been subject to the whims of what is happening to our major customers around the world. That probably, you know, has not changed. But so I'm not sure to what extent that is going to necessarily impact the exporting of our products from Canada, only to the extent that farmers may find they're receiving lesser return than they might have received had they been able to retain their own organizations. I think it would be at that end of the spectrum where the impact would be.
A lack of loyalty to Canadian farmers by organizations that aren't farmer-owned would not necessarily have its own impact beyond that.
No, I think they'll still be fighting strongly to get the farmers' business, and there will be a fair amount of competition. There's not many companies left now. But there's still enough there that I think they will compete for export grain. Mm. You still have Richardson's, you still have Cargill's, and you have Viterra. Those are the three major ones that are going to be competing for exporting Canadian grain. Mm. And I'm just saying again that those organizations' loyalty and interest in making returns are for the shareholders, not necessarily for the farmers. Mm-hmm. Now, they would say, well, we're not going to get the farmers' business if we don't pay them what they should get. But I think with the pools there, they might get paid a little bit better for what they produce than they may with the present organizations. And I'm not being critical, that's their job to do it the way that they have to.
So that leads me to a discussion. We talked about your involvement with the Wheat Board in relation to your job with Department of Agriculture. And once you got to Manitoba Pool Elevator, then that would have been a far closer relationship with the Wheat Board?
Yeah, it was much closer relationship, yes. Yeah. And the pools, I would say, probably had considerable influence on the Wheat Board, too, in terms of them adopting policies that were suitable to farmers and appropriate for farmers.
So what were the pool's issues with the Wheat Board? Any?
Well, they tended to be, of course they were concerned with the international marketing, but they tended to be considered concerned with how they impacted back in the country. Quotas, for example, rail car service. Those were the kind of major issues that the Wheat Board were involved in that would get back to the farm side of things, and that's where a lot of the concerns would register.
If we think of the Wheat Board in relation to comments about the change in the industry, would you care to comment on the future of the Wheat Board and its importance to Canadian farmers?
Well, I would argue that it's as important to them today as it has been for a number of years, although the a number of the major buyers now, a lot of our customers for grain used to be single desk agencies themselves, and they preferred dealing with the Wheat Board. That has changed to some extent, and some of those buyers have now gone to private sector buying. And in a sense, that doesn't mean the board still can't deal and doesn't deal with those buyers, but it's not quite as easy, if you will, as dealing one-on-one, one agency selling, one agency buying. It's more of a challenge, I would say, for the Wheat Board. Now, what the board has always done is what they used to do for the customers that wanted to deal with a private sector rather than the board. They would use agents of the board. And the company I was with in Montreal, that was a major part of our business, acting as an agent for the Canadian Wheat Board in exporting to private trade, whereas the board, most of its exporting was agency to agency. So that has changed to and made it, I think, more of a challenge for the Wheat Board now in its international marketing and dealing with probably more buyers than they used to deal with at one time. In a sense, I don't mean more countries or that, but more buyers within some of the countries.
Any country in particular that comes to mind when you think of that?
Well, I'm not really current with what the countries have done, but this is certainly a view that I have picked up from what I hear, that there's been quite a change. And when we did this work for the Western Grain Marketing Panel, we had one major study in which all the major customers of the Wheat Board were visited to see where they were at and what their views were on the board. And that was back in the mid-90s. And it was a very positive view on the most part that they had of the board because they liked dealing with them. But as I say, since that time, I think there's been some loosening among some of those countries for buying more through their private trade than necessarily as state agencies, or both perhaps in some cases.
XCan was operating, I guess, almost like an agent for the off-board wheat. What were the synergies or possible conflicts between Wheat Board marketing and XCan marketing?
XCan did some agency work for the board, not a lot. At one time, we were the largest agent of the wheat board on their agency board marketing at ConAgra. But they concentrated, canola was a big commodity for Xcan. That was what really got it started. And so they handled largely the non-board grains and the export. As I say, they would from time to time do some agency business with the board. I wouldn't say it was a huge amount of their business.
What happened to Xcan?
Well, that's a good question. I think it got absorbed within UGG when it reached that stage. And I don't think it exists as such now. I don't believe it does.
No. I don't think so either.
No.
So, sorry, speed things up a bit here. I don't know, Bea, about a second interview, whether we should plan that. It would be something that you and Mary would do. Mm-hmm. Because we do have the ConAgra experience, and then we have the consulting or the board, what was the panel you said? The
Western Grain Marketing Panel.
Yeah, panel, which I think has valid.
Well, I'll tell you on that one. I have two documents which I can give you. The one I'm going to have to get back from you, because when you're in a condo, you're always getting rid of things, and I threw out the other ones. But let me quickly...
Would a second interview be okay, B? From your perspective? And
you can... But this, our panel, we put out this as an information piece, and it's a good summary of the whole industry.
Oh, okay.
And then this was our report... To Minister Goodale, after we'd finished our work. It was about a little over a year's work that we did on this. So this will have, you know, a good summary. It's kind of for general information,
mm-hmm.
and it has a little bit on terminals, not a lot, but there's a whole historical overview of what happened, key happenings in the industry, and then all in the system and that. This is the one I haven't got another copy of, so I'd like to get it back if I could.
Yes, so what I can do is I can scan them.
Pardon?
I can scan them.
Scan. Maybe you could do
are you,
that.
Are you taping or no?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I can scan them and get them back to you.
So I don't know whether there's enough to warrant another another interview or not. I would leave that in your hands. We probably got through the most of it.
You know, I'd like to leave it open to another interview, and it may be a shorter one, but I think... if you and Mary review those reports as well, some of the details of that information can come out in it. Because even though it's there, it's so much better to have it voiced.
Yes.
Rather than just say, you know, read the paper.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think given the fact that you visited all the customers around the world is...
didn't myself, but,
no, but
we had a researcher
group.
Do that, yeah.
Boy, that would have been a nice job to be the researcher, huh?
Denny Stevens did that work for us,
and
Frank Rowan. Frank Rowan used to be at the wheat board.
Oh, yes, both of those fellows on our...
Have you? Well, we asked Dennis about that consulting work he did for the panel.
Okay. So just to wrap up today then, from Mantle Pool Elevators, you went to...
To ConAgra.
Directly to ConAgra,
in Montreal,
and you were stationed in Montreal.
Yeah.
Okay, and then from there?
From there, we came back to Manitoba, and I set up this consulting business and did that for, I don't know, we came back in 93, and I did that till about 96, and then Jim Downey persuaded me to go back as Deputy Minister of Industry, Trade and Tourism. Mm-hmm. Well, I went back as Assistant Deputy for a short time because he wanted to finish a reorganization he was doing, and then his deputy then went east, and so he asked me to take on the deputy's job. And then Jim decided he wasn't going to run in the next election. And I had to go in for an operation, and I was, I think, 64 by that time, so I thought, well, maybe this is a good time just to pack it in. I stayed on with the new minister for just till he got his feet wet, and Herb Tweed was his name, and who's now a federal member in Ottawa. And then I retired. Then I did a bit of consulting after that.
In the grain industry?
Well, no, it was food processing. I did was involved with some consultants from Toronto on that, and one from here. And then I did some work with two of our boys were in business down in the States, so I did some work with them, but that was a little different. That was the kind that doesn't pay.
Well, we'll call it a day for
okay.
today. And
I'm sorry, I'm having to kind of rush away here. But,
oh, no, that we recognize the time limits when, mm-hmm. when we set this up, but I wanted to at least get the major part of the interview underway.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. And on top